Welcome to the Ion Basketball Podcast, the Pick and Troll Podcast. I'm your host, Zach Harper. Today's special guest, no Matt Moore, no Royce Young, but I've got Jeff Skin Wade from the Dallas Mavericks broadcast team. Skin, how's it going?
Man, it's going good. Good to talk to you, brother. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks for being on. Exciting little gear up for the regular season, a big season for the Dallas Mavericks. Just off of what you've seen so far, training camp, preseason, how do you like their chances?
Well, you know, I kind of gauge it with, the perspective of last year being such a bummer year. Dallas had obviously been on an incredible run ever since the whole, you know, Cuban buying the team and having it started with Dirk and Nash and Finley. And they went on a long stretch making the playoffs every year and being a relevant team. And last year was a real gut kick for any Mav fan or anybody following the team because they ended up 500. They missed the playoffs. Dirk ended up missing almost 30 games due to injury. And so it was a real setback. And because the Mavericks had gone from winning a championship to trying to put themselves in a position to be able to go after what has been deemed around here a big fish, whether you see that as Darren Williams 2 seasons ago or this past season, Chris Paul, or this past offseason, Chris Paul or Dwight Howard. And they weren't able to get the guy. And in the meantime, they've kind of put together these sort of transition teams of one-year contracts and such. I think looking at it through that filter, this team will be far more entertaining than last year's team. I think this is a playoff team. I think they'll be really good offensively. The real question is, can they get enough stops to win important games? Because defensively, it's going to be a real challenge for them.
Yeah, and just this week, you know, there were some concerns from Rick Carlisle about Samuel Dalembert's conditioning. And then, you know, Sammy kind of chalked it up to a back injury from early in training camp. And then after the second game, Carlisle seemed to kind of sing his praises. Is a Dalembert-Sean Marion combination enough to make up for Monte Ellis or Jose Calderon or even, you know, Dirk in his advanced NBA age? You know, he can still move into position, but there's only so much athletically he can do at this point.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's tough on any team, even if you have, and I guess the standard around here is like the 1 year of Tyson Chandler, where
right.
He did such a good job defensively. But if you have Tyson or if you have Dwight Howard or whoever you have back there, if you get torched on the perimeter, it's a bad scene. And I guess really the most recent example we could use is the Lakers of last year. They were terrible defensively, and it didn't matter that Dwight Howard was back there. And I know Howard went through a lot of injury concerns, but it seemed like every time I watched the Lakers, it was someone flying by one of their guards and Dwight Howard coming over just in time to foul somebody. So, you know, the question is, can Dalembert kind of stem the tide? You know, one of the things that the Mavericks had great success doing when Dwayne Casey was here was a team defensive concept, funneling guys
yes.
where they wanted to funnel them. Now, they had fundamentally better defensive players to do it. I think that's one of the reasons Deshaun Stevenson was starting games during that playoff run. And, you know, even Jason Kidd was a really smart defender. If he didn't have the quicks anymore, he at least had the anticipation skills. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure on Dalembert, but there's even more pressure on Calderon and Ellis to just provide some sort of resistance. It can't be just straight turnstile up top to start the thing, because I don't care who you are, you're going to get in foul trouble on your back line. Dalembert, you know, he only averaged 16 minutes a game last year, and kind of he's really over the last 3 years, he's kind of fallen off the NBA map in terms of being a super relevant, you know, big man. He was never a superstar, but he was always, you know, at his prime, he was a good defender, and he's always been a good rebounder per minute. He's been a guy that, I mean, even last year, playing only 16 minutes, he got you rebounds. So it's really going to be more about, can they do it in waves? You know, Dalembert needs to give them 24 good minutes a night. I think they expect B. Wright to step up and play a bigger role this year in terms of a backup role. And even though he's size-wise probably more of a power forward, I think most teams don't have two legit centers anyways. And what you're really looking for, I think, is your help defense. And can your big defend in the high pick-and-roll situation and retreat and hedge and do some of those things? So there's a lot of pressure on Dalembert, but it really does have to start with Ellis and Calderon, and they expect Evan Harris to be a part of the rotation when he gets healthy to provide some degree of resistance up front. You can't just leave it all on the back line, guys.
Yeah, completely agree. And maybe even, you know, I'm in Minneapolis where there are definite defensive concerns going into this year, and it kind of gets to the point where you think, well, maybe the best defense is a really good offense. And that, I think, is something you can expect from the Dallas Mavericks. Is, you know, you assume Dirk is going to have a bounce back year. You've got a lot of firepower in the backcourt with Monte Ellis. I think him as a second gun playing off of someone like Dirk is probably the ideal way for him to play, as opposed to the Golden State Milwaukee Bucks years, where he's just kind of had free reign and Jose Calderon shooting and setting guys up. You know, maybe you have a top 10 offense to kind of offset the defensive problems, right?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right, Zach. And I'm real interested in, excuse me, the evaluations of Monte Ellis, because he's not a, you know, in the last couple of years especially, not a particularly, let's just be honest, he's a low efficient offensive player.
Yeah.
But I believe that those are relative things that need context. And so, with all due respect to the Milwaukee Bucks, being on a floor with Brandon Jennings and Ilyasova and Sanders and Emba Mute and these guys, that there ain't no space. There's because you don't really have to defend any of that front line. And I don't think it's any coincidence that Brandon Jennings and Monte Ellis both had horrible efficiency numbers, because, you know, when I saw those games, I saw a lot of bad shots with 4 seconds left on the shot clock.
Yes.
You know, you dribble around, you have this rudderless offense. You know, the defense isn't concerned. But, you know, you set a high screen and roll with somebody who's not a threat to roll and score, not a threat to pop, and the defense just stays put. There's no room to operate. And the biggest frustration for the Mavericks last year was, and you could just watch it. You know, I talk about, you know, we saw this a lot with Roddy B, where he was effective when all he was trying to do was score the ball. When he was trying to run some sort of an offense or get people involved, it was a train wreck. Like, you could see it in his body language. It just, you could see the uncertainty of not knowing what to do. And I think last year, that high screen and roll with Dirk Nowitzki is, if you have a determined offensive player, it's a beautiful thing. This is why Jason Terry was so good for so many years in the two-man game, because he would come off that screen and he knew exactly what to do. There was no hesitancy at all. What we saw last year with Darren Collison, even more so than O.J. Mayo, was we saw a guy come off that screen and you saw him wait and not wasn't sure what to do. And if you don't recognize that seam and attack it immediately, the defenses are too good and they're going to rotate and your opportunity is lost. And so whatever you think about Montel's efficiency or his shot or whatever, he is a determined scorer. And I think we will see a completely different floor when he comes off that screen. He's going to know what he wants to do with it. You mentioned Calderon. Calderon, in a lot of those situations, will be off the ball, where he's a fantastic catch-and-shoot guy. Vince Carter has proven to be a very good catch-and-shoot guy. They've got Wayne Ellington. And then you got Dirk, or if they have Wright in that role, rolling to the basket. They have a much different floor offensively and a different mentality player with the ball in his hands. Will Monte Ellis go off the reservation and put up some bad shots? Sure. But I think you're going to see his offensive efficiency numbers go way up, because it's a different floor, it's a different game, and he knows how to stick the ball in the basket. And I think that's going to be a very high-octane offense.
I've never been a Monte guy. His second or third year, I think, was probably his best year, and that's when he was, you know, kind of in that reserve role or that second or even third gun for the Warriors. And then since then, yep, it's just, you know, like you said, he's not a high-efficiency guy at all. But over the last year or so, I've really come around to the guys that are that gunner mentality. I mean, I called last year the year of the gunner, because you had Jamal Crawford, you had J.R. Smith vying for that six-man award. And there is something to be said about those guys who at least draw defensive attention. Whether we think Monte Ellis is a good scorer or not, or an efficient scorer or not, there's still a guy on defense in front of him who doesn't want to get burned by him, right? And you're still going to get some kind of rotation over if he does drive. I think the key is finding a way for Rick Carlisle to get the message to him that, hey, we don't need those pull-up 20-footers. We need you to attack the basket.
Yeah, and Zach, I love the point you're making there, because, you know, we see changes in the game, we see changes in philosophy, we see reactions and all those sorts of things. And the best example I can give is just all the hand-wringing of people over whether or not Russell Westbrook is a quote-unquote point guard or
right,
not. You can argue about that all you want. I'm just watching a guy that puts so much pressure on your defense, the whole thing collapses. And, you know, I think we're moving I love the idea of a pure point guard, a classic point guard that gets people involved. I think there's a lot of benefit to that. I'm not in any way discrediting that. That's a great thing, and that's one of the reasons Jose Calderon is here, because they have confidence in him to be a traditional point guard and run the offense. But if we're in the day and age, I just call him catalyst. And whether it's Harden or whether you put the ball in Durant's hands or Westbrook, you got to have guys that put pressure on the defense and make your help defense collapse and make, you know, open up things for other guys. Whether he's a point guard or not, I don't care. How much pressure is he putting on that defense and creating opportunities for other people? And this is the day and age of that. And as many of those guys as you can collect, the better. And so I'm not ever going to try and make an argument that Monte Ellis is some sort of a point guard.
Right.
But I think within that definition of what we're talking about, he's definitely an offensive catalyst that will create opportunities for other people. And last year's Maverick team had nobody that could do that on a consistent basis. It was very frustrating to watch, and that's the role that he's going to fill here.
Yeah, and I mean, there are the jokes of Monte have it all, and you know, he'd rather put up a shot than pass. He actually has some surprising assist numbers for his career. But when he was with Golden State, I always thought, like, if you could get him to play with Dwight Howard, like, that seems like the perfect amount of attention for him to play off of. You know, you've got a central
right.
figure. And now, while Dirk is not exactly the low post presence you would expect the defense to spend on Howard, who, you know, is going to draw a lot of fouls and a lot of interior double teams, you can play off that. I mean, Dirk's obviously a better offensive player overall. It's just a different position of the floor. And I would imagine Rick Carlisle is a smart enough coach to figure out how to play off that. I mean, he's got a pretty decent track record, right?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. And the thing I really dig about Carlisle is his willingness to be flexible in terms of, it's not, okay, here's my system, this is what we're going to run. It's, all right, you know, he started using this term a couple years ago where he talked about flow offense. And basically the idea being that the scouting is so advanced now that they know all your sets. And I'm sure you've done this at a game where you watch the sideline when the team's bringing the ball up and there's four guys jumping up and down shouting everything that's about to happen. And so, you know, Rick's philosophy on this was, look, the scouting is so good, you basically want to do things within the flow of a game and have guys. And, you know, to me, it's pickup basketball. Like, if you've got a group of guys you play with, you're not running plays, but you know what all these guys want to do, where they want the ball, how to get them the ball. And it's not something that you set up, and conversely, it's a little more difficult to scout defensively and to have guys sit on certain things if it's happening out of the flow of the secondary game or a transition game. And so Rick is a big believer in that. Now, when it's time to draw a play and get a shot, he's one of the best at it. And he's also, you know, not married to one particular type of philosophy. When he first came to the Mavericks, they spent like, I want to say it was like 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks, trying to install the Princeton offense. And it was not going to work for that team because there weren't enough good passers and not enough good guys that are used to moving without the ball and things that offense requires. And so Rick scrapped it like 3 weeks into camp and just moved in a different direction. And it's because he has a wide base of stuff to draw on. He's got wide offensive philosophies. And at the end of the day, it's about getting your best players in the position to get the ball where they're going to light it up. And Rick's a good believer in that. And I think Monte Ellis is going to thrive. And we had Rick on our radio show here in Dallas a couple weeks ago. And the day before, we had Monte Ellis on. And so we're talking to Monte, and we're like, all right, he'd said that Carlisle met him down in Houston and they worked on things. And my natural assumption is that, you know, Rick's working on, like, okay, here's good shots, here's bad shots, Rick was working on his shot mechanics with him.
Really? Well,
you know, like a college coach, you know, like, let's just get back to the basic fundamentals. You know, I'm looking at your shot, your field goal percentage, and all of us, our natural inclination is to go, well, he's taking bad shots. Rick puts a positive spin on it and goes, you know what, I think there's a few things in your mechanics that'll start helping you make a few more shots. You know, it just goes back to basketball 101, and he loves working with guys individually. I think if you ask Corey Brewer about his, you know, sort of resurgence the last couple of years after he had been thrown onto the NBA scrap heap, he'll tell you about all the time Rick put in with him here when he was a Maverick. Rick loves working with guys on just basic fundamental principles of basketball, and I just thought that was fascinating that his first thing he wants to do with Monte is help him with his shot mechanics.
It's weird. I mean, Monte's been in the league, 10, 11 years, something like that? It's been, or maybe not that long,
long,
long time. That's kind of fascinating that he would go to those basics, but I guess that's what a really good coach does, right?
Yep, I thought so too, man.
You mentioned Roddy Bobois earlier. What happened with Roddy?
A couple things. Number one, you know, I think it was a disaster trying to turn him into a point guard.
Yeah.
Because it's not what he was. He didn't grow up playing the game here. He didn't even really grow up playing the game, you know, there. And so he was a freakish athlete. He had an incredible wingspan. He had all these tools, but he didn't have a mental toughness about him. I'm not knocking the guy. I personally like him quite a bit. He was one of the nicer guys to come through here, but he would get very down on himself, and especially, you know, trying to convert. Like, the most success they had with him was, here's the ball, go do what you do. And he was perfectly suited to be that sort of combo guard off the bench. But the other massive setback for him was he was brittle. And at one point when he would hit the floor, none of his teammates would go over and pick him up, not because they didn't like him, because they wanted him to learn, nope, you're not hurt, get up and play through it.
Yeah.
And I just don't think he really was cut out for that. Now, he had some legitimate injuries, don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to say that no one thought he was faking injuries, but it was more of a thing of, it was like minor injuries, and they always held him back, and whenever he would turn a corner, there would be another one. And Rick is notorious for, like, getting a guy's back in press conferences. Like, you very, very rarely hear him say anything critical or negative about a guy or anything that could be perceived as that way. And I'll never forget, last year, this was probably about February, before one of the games, there's a little 6 o'clock presser, and someone asked him about Roddy B, and he goes, the guy's just got to get healthy, okay? If he can't play, he can't be a factor for us. No one's asking about his health. They're asking about his progression as a player, and he's talking about his health. So I think, you know, there was a number of things. There was the transition to a position he wasn't comfortable with. There was the transition to this country. But ultimately, he couldn't stay healthy enough to develop and get the reps and be a guy that could be counted on. And, you know, it just ended up holding him back because he had explosive talent, just could never put it together.
Yeah, it almost seemed like he would have been a perfect kind of replacement for that J.J. Barea role.
Yeah, sure.
I think
that's exactly right. And the idea of not necessarily running an offense, but, you know, J.J. Barea, you're a Timberwolf fan. You know he's not a traditional point guard.
Right.
He's a scorer. That's what he is. He's just, you know, the guy's 5'9". And so you need to put him in pick-and-roll situations and let him push it and transition and those kind of things. He can be a very effective player. You know, speaking of the Timberwolves, I always, when you talk about these sort of combo guards, I always think of Hudson. What's the guy? Ernie Hudson. Or Troy.
Troy Hudson.
Yeah. I always think of Troy Hudson coming off the bench. And, hell, somebody might not touch the ball for 7 possessions.
Right.
But, you know, there was an effectiveness to what he did. And he would create for other people just by being the sort of whirling dervish. But now every team's got a guy like that, maybe 2, and sometimes that's your starting point guard. That's kind of what Barea is. That's what Roddy B could become. I just don't know at this point how much NBA life he's got. I think he may be a guy that has to go to another part of the world to put it together.
Yeah, he's only 24, 25 years old, and it seems weird that after such a promising rookie year that he would just be kind of an afterthought now.
Right. Yeah. It, you know what? He's got to go somewhere where he can get some reps, get entrenched somewhere and build, because really he's not even developed as a player. I mean, he's been here, what is it, 4 years, I think, here. And he's not even really developed as a player at all. There's not one thing that you can go, that's what Roddy B does. That's what he hangs his hat on. He's an inconsistent shooter. He's not a distributor. I mean, he's had flashes of all these different kinds of things. He's even had moments where he was a pretty good defender, but never could put it together consistently. So if someone says, hey, what does Roddy B do? I don't even know what to tell you. I don't know what his skill set is after being here for 4 years.
I've switching gears a little bit. It kind of speaks to the inconsistent shooter comment you just made. When I was in Sacramento, just starting out doing this, there was a pregame moment in which the Mavericks were in town, and on one end of the court, Dante Green was shooting jumpers. On the other end of the court, there was Dirk Nowitzki. Mm-hmm. And Mario Elie was the assistant coach for the Kings at the time, and he's watching Dante and getting increasingly angry, and he looks over at Dirk and sees him shooting, and he looks back at Dante, and he's like, look at Dante. He's like, I don't know who told him who was a shooter. You know, it's a different release point every time. And he goes, now look at Dirk. It's the same release point no matter where he is, no matter what the shot is. And he was just kind of marveling at Dirk while being disgusted by Dante. And that moment always stuck out with me. And it just, it's kind of been a thing of, it must be, in your job, like, it must be a joy to be around Dirk Nowitzki all the time.
Yeah, I mean, I can't say enough incredible things around the guy, about the guy. And it really, at some point, it just kind of sounds like, you know, corny broadcaster talking
right.
about how much he, but, I mean, I swear to you, it's true. Like, even, like, off the court, like, you won't find a better person, really, in any walk of life. It really is, you know, this franchise is so blessed to have him here. And, man, we are, you know, this is football country. I have a sports talk show with a buddy of mine. We're on from 2 to 6, and probably, honestly, 70% of what we do is Cowboys football. Not because that's what we want to do. It's because that's where we live. However, Dirk is such a unique person, and people have responded to him in such a unique way. I almost look at him as he's kind of now in the same class as Roger Staubach here, where Staubach was a guy. Staubach's like a, I mean, he made so much money after football doing this commercial real estate company, and it's a massive company, and he does business with all these people. He is a icon of the city of Dallas. He's not from here, but he played for the Cowboys, made his life here. His kids grew up here. They're all important business people in Dallas, on and on and on. I see, honestly and truly, Dirk as being that same guy. Dirk is a guy who I think will live in Dallas for the rest of his life and be a massive part of the community, a very well-respected guy. He got married, you know, a couple years ago. He's got a newborn child. I think she's like almost 3 months old now. I see him settling into Dallas and being a part of the fabric of the community for decades to come in the exact same way that Staubach is. And I, you know, I just think he's been that special and that many people love him here. And that's why this season is going to be over. He's going to be off of that contract. And I don't know what contract he's going to take, but he's going to take a small contract so that Dallas can be more competitive. He can stay here and keep playing. This is the only place he wants to be. And it's just this franchise is so lucky that they got him. And, you know, Donnie Nelson was the guy that had his eye on him. I think, you know, a lot of people give Don Nelson credit for it, but Donnie was the one who was all over this. And that's the greatest thing that's ever happened to this city outside of whatever's happened with the Dallas Cowboys sports-wise is Dirk Nowitzki being drafted by this team. When, you know, Pitino had his eye on him with the Celtics, he wasn't on anybody else's radar. And, boy, there was an article in the paper every day Dirk's rookie year comparing him to Paul Pierce because the Mavericks could have drafted Paul Pierce,
right.
And it was just – look at the stats. What a terrible decision. Well, hey, Paul Pierce has gone on to a magnificent career. Great player. Love him. No disrespect. But he ain't Dirk Nowitzki. And, you know, there is a time where there was a Boston team that was not even competitive. They were so bad, and Paul Pierce quit suiting up at one point. I'm sure you remember all that.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of thing would never happen on Dirk's watch. And that's not a shot at Paul Pierce. I'm not knocking Paul Pierce. He's a brilliant player. But there's just a difference with Dirk Nowitzki. That kind of thing would never happen. He would never allow it to happen. And think about this team, this Maverick team last year. I mean, it was – calling them mediocre is nice.
It's a brutal roster. I mean, that was a really brutal roster.
Dirk missed a third of the year, and they still were 500 and just missed out on the playoffs. And that is a testament to Dirk. You talking about lugging around some garbage.
Oh, God.
That's what he's done for a decade and a half, man. He has been a special player here.
Yeah, he's just – there was a time, you know, as a Timberwolves fan, there was a little Duncan, Garnett, Weber, Dirk debate going on all the time in the mid – you know, the decade of the early 2000s. And it was – as a Timberwolves fan, I wanted to just dislike all of them. But
right.
But because I wanted Garnett to be the best, and then at a certain point, I still believe that during his time here, Garnett was a better player. But you could easily argue that Dirk had a bigger impact with less of an all-around game, just because he's that damn good.
I think Dirk is the, and I was always a big Garnett fan, by the way. You know, and I loved those debates, and I loved all those conversations, and obviously, the golden age of the power forward. You know, it kind of started with Karl Malone, but it was those new guys that came along that took it over, the four guys you mentioned, and it's become obviously a big offensive position now. And I always had tremendous respect for Garnett. But the real interesting thing is, like, whenever people say, talk about the player that makes everyone else around them better, you traditionally think of the point guard and you look at assist numbers and all these different types of things.
Right.
But if you just watch the way a defense hugs Dirk and all of the things that it opens up, opportunities for other people, that's a true definition of making everyone else around you better just by creating opportunities for them the second you step out on the floor. It's a pretty stunning thing to watch. And it just speaks to all the frustrations of last year when you had Darren Collison and O.J. Mayo not able to take advantage of these things that you don't see in an NBA game. These are golden opportunities that are handed over to you on a silver platter, and they couldn't take advantage of those things. And that was a big frustration for, I know, Mavericks coaches last year. And, you know, it's hard to come in for 1 year and make your mark and all these types of things, but I think the Mavericks figured out very early that those were not guys that were going to be a part of their future just because of these opportunities that they were squandering.
Yeah, and it's got to be difficult for Dirk just because there's 2007, the MVP year, they lose in the first round, and they were kind of written off after that. No one really took them seriously, even though they were a really good team.
Right.
And it gets to the point where the 2011 playoff run, I know myself included, a lot of people outside of Dallas thought, well, Portland's just going to upset them in the first round.
Mm-hmm.
And then he goes on that incredible run, and really not just him, it's the team was fantastic. The schemes were fantastic. Everyone played their role. Everyone executed the way they needed to, and they rode his brilliance into a championship. And then to have the team, and I still defend Cuban on this, and a lot of people disagree because of, you know, now hindsight is 2020, but
right.
I don't think you lock up that much money long term in an aging team. Sure, you have a chance to defend the title, but I think there is something to be. I mean, if they end up grabbing Deron Williams or they grab Dwight Howard, you know, everyone calls it a brilliant move. But because they missed out on those guys, you know, now it's a failure and a terrible decision. He was so wrong, and I don't know. Maybe they do defend the title if they keep the team together, but it's got to be hard going from a title team and then having that layoff because of the lockout and then coming back and just nothing has been right ever since.
Yeah, and, you know, the thing you got to look at it too is, I mean, Dwight Howard's wishy-washiness really blew up the Mavericks' plan because if you look at the soundness of the plan was to have that much cap space and a summer with Chris Paul, Deron Williams, and Dwight Howard.
Yep.
But Dwight Howard blew that up. So you had that cap space when it was just Deron Williams. And, you know, it's the idea of, well, you know, what you have is more sound than what the future could be. You've got to roll with it. But and people, it became this really divisive issue here in town, and everyone was so mad about it. And I was like, look, the philosophy was good. It didn't work out. It didn't, but the philosophy was sound. And you look at, like, a good example is the Spurs, right? And they were able to keep Tim Duncan, Tony Parker, and Ginobili together. Man, if the Mavericks had re-signed Tyson Chandler to the money he got with the Knicks, you would basically have Dirk, Tyson, and Marion. You know, those are good players, but only one of those guys can stick the ball in the basket. It's not like three two-way style players like the Spurs had put together. And you would have been spending about $10 million more a year just for those three core guys. And it was so hard, you know, for the Mavericks to score for the longest time. They needed someone to take the offensive pressure off Dirk. And so they made the decision to move on, and boy, it was hotly debated down here, and everyone was mad, and it was a big thing, and obviously Chandler was loved. But what Maverick fans forgot is that they were able to get Tyson Chandler for the expiring contract of Eric Dampier, you know? and it's a Tyson Chandler that had been traded a couple of times. I'm not knocking the guy. He was great here. But the idea that he was suddenly, you know, Wilt Chamberlain, and you got to pay him $13.5 million a year, I just don't think your average fan, you know, put as much thought into that. It was just kind of the emotional reaction of the thing. Everyone hated to lose Tyson. He was one of the most likable guys. He was the best center they ever had, even for 1 year. But, you know, we've seen Tyson in some playoff games go for 6 points. I don't think you can pay, you know, $13 million a year to a guy that's scoring 6 or 7 points if you only have one guy on the floor that can stick the ball in the basket. If they had two guys, why, of course. but they had to figure out a way to chart a new course for their team, and it hadn't worked out for them. They're open to the criticism, but I think the philosophy on it was a sound philosophy. It just didn't pan out for them.
Yeah, I agree, and I just think that, especially with the CBA, none of us are cap experts. We all read the same things, and we try to learn the CBA as much as we can. But I would venture to say that the front office for the Mavericks and Mark Cuban understand the business side of that probably better than I do, better than the average fan does. And because of that, I think you look at the lay of the land and you just say, we reached this expectation, or we reached this goal that maybe we didn't even expect to get to in that season. And now, instead of overpaying, you just maybe kind of ride with a different direction and try to stay flexible for the future, because, you know, the present is fantastic and you won the championship, but the future is really the more important part of that whole situation, right?
Oh yeah, totally. And the other thing about it is, if they had kept that team together, you know, we're going back in time and who knows what would have happened or, you know, wouldn't have happened. But I gave as an example, the last time there was a lockout, that Utah Jazz team, that was the Stockton and Malone and all those guys, and then you had the 50-game season, and that team wore down to a nub because it was an older team. And people are like, well, you have a longer offseason. That's not what kills the older guys. It's the back-to-backs. And in the case of, the shortened season, the back-to-back-to-backs. You would have had an older team. You had Dirk with some knee issues. I don't know that that team would have been, like, built to ride another long playoff run at its age in a shortened season. I think that was probably pretty unlikely.
Now, you went to North Texas, correct?
Yes, that is where I graduated
from. Is that the same as the North Texas State University from which Tony Mitchell went to college?
It is, indeed.
Is he going to surpass you as the top NBA product of North Texas?
I think he already has, without doing anything in the league yet. I tell you what, you know who's already ahead of me is our play-by-play guy, Mark Folliwell.
Oh, he's from North Texas?
North Texas, here in this region, has cranked out a lot of broadcasters. And, really, really good broadcasters. Not guys like me that are like, how did I end up here? and Folliwell is an absolute beast.
He's really good.
He's a brilliant guy.
He's really
good. I think like the most important quality for a play-by-play guy to have, besides obviously, you know, the voice and that kind of thing, is to have a steel trap memory.
Yeah.
To be able to recall something on a moment's notice. And Mark Folliwell is the kind of guy that knows the name of every person in every arena there is. He never forgets anything. And you can go, you can literally go, hey, Folliwell, when's the last time Dirk had 45? Well, he had it on January 12th. I remember it very well. He hit it with a late second shot, and he was being defended by, Tim Thomas. I mean, it's nuts, his recall ability. He just pulls it out of his brain. And so he's exceptionally smart, a brilliant memory. He's got a great voice. He's doing some soccer play-by-play. He's been doing some college football. He loves living here because he's from here. And he's very loved in this town, but it really does shock me that he's not already in the mix at ESPN or TNT for some of the national stuff. I really think he's that good.
Yeah, I watch a lot of League Pass, and there are a lot of local announcers that I would not mention as, oh, that guy's good, or even that guy's adequate. But the Mavericks broadcast team is really, and this isn't just me because I'm talking to you, I've mentioned this on Twitter all the time, like, they're one of my top five for sure. Like, it's just a very good conversation about basketball that doesn't have really even a hint of bias, which that's what drives. Like, I get a lot of these announcers are paid by the team, and so there's going to be some incentive to root for that team. But the fact that you get an even perspective on the game, no matter who's winning or what play is happening, it's kind of refreshing, and it's great.
That's an awesome thing to hear. Very much appreciate that. I mean, we are all very much Maverick fans and want the Mavericks to win, but we're also like basketball guys. And so, you know, I'm always wanting the Mavericks to win. I can't hide it, but I also, you know, I'm not going to, no disrespect to any other broadcast or what they do, I just don't want to come off phony and insincere. And, you know, I don't like that stuff. You know, what you see is what you see. And that's the way we roll with it.
It's much appreciated. Real quick before I let you go.
Yeah.
I was all in on the Mavericks as the eighth seed. I thought, you know, I like the components. I figured as long as there's not a major injury, they're in. And then I was talking to a few people during this week, and I got talked out of it. So because of D'Alembert, because of the defensive concerns in the backcourt, there's not a great deal of depth for the interior. Talk me back into them.
Well, I would just say this. The best thing you can tell people, look, this season is all going to come down to, in terms of their playoff hopes, it's going to come down to Dirk's health.
Yeah.
Like I said, Dirk missed a third of the season last year, and it was a 500 team, and that was a significantly, at least from a depth and talent standpoint, worse team than this year's team. They barely missed the playoffs with Dirk missing a third of the season. Dirk is he's still too good. And so they will score points and they will outscore people. They're also a much better rebound team than they were last year, and that caused them a lot of problems. I think they're good enough to make the playoffs. I think, you know, if they have maximized what this team can do, I think you're looking at like a 6 or 7 seed. I think they're likely going to be fighting for that fourth spot, but I think they get in. And, you know, they got a lot of guys in this roster that have played a lot of important basketball. And when it gets to the end of the games, you know how much that means and how important it is. They're going to close games better this year. They're going to be way more efficient offensively this year. They're going to take advantage of situations they didn't take advantage of last year. And I think that you know this, Zach, you're crazy to doubt a healthy Dirk Nowitzki until he proves you wrong. So the idea that it can't be one of the 8 best teams in the Western Conference with Dirk healthy, I beg to differ. I think he'll get it done.
I doubted it 2 years ago and looked like an idiot. I only picked them in one of the 4 rounds they won, and I guess I looked smart for 25% of the playoffs when it came to that.
There you go, man. At least you hit one of those shots.
Yeah, exactly. Well, we can listen to you on 105.3 The Fan, correct? 2 to 6 every day, Central Time?
Yeah, 2 to 6 every day, and if you want to go to the website there, you can stream us. They got a little buyer there, and then, of course, working all the Mavs home podcast with Mark Burwell and Derek Harper.
Awesome, and we can follow you on Twitter, at SkinWade. Skin, really appreciate it. I'm a huge fan, and you guys do a great job. Thank you.
Awesome. Anytime, Zach. Appreciate it, man.